Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jeffrey Bader. I'm a senior fellow with the John L. Thornton China Center here at Brookings. For those of you who were expecting Tom Christensen, who was on the program as the moderator, Tom unfortunately had a personal emergency and is unable to make it today, much to his and our regret. This event on understanding the U.S. pivot to Asia is sponsored by the John L. Thornton China Center and the Center for Northeast Asia Policy Studies at Brookings. The program will be available in audio and video on our website in about a day or two, for those of you who don't pay as close attention as you should. President Obama's November trip to Asia was described by members of his administration as illustrating the pivot in U.S. policy from preoccupation with the 10-year-old war in Iraq that was ending and U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, where withdrawal of U.S. troops was beginning. Some administration members described a pivot to the Asia-Pacific as central to the new strategy. Others talk more generally of a pivot to areas of higher priority to the United States, of which they identify the Asia-Pacific as one. Now, the president's trip focused attention on the Asia-Pacific region, as such trips invariably do. But in this case, the focus was facilitated by a series of steps taken during the trip, the U.S. joining the East Asia Summit and the president participating for the first time, highlighting of disputes over the South China Sea at the East Asia Summit and through Secretary Clinton's visit to the Philippines, announcement of an umbrella agreement on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, grouping nine Asia-Pacific countries, the U.S.-Australia agreement to deploy U.S. Marines to Darwin, Australia, on a rotational basis for joint exercises and training, and the dramatic opening to Burma, highlighted by Secretary Clinton's visit to that country, ending years of U.S.-imposed isolation. The media and some Asian observers chose to see all these steps as part of a blueprint for American containment, constraining, or pushback against a rising China. By contrast, administration explanations of the overall strategy and individual decisions emphasized U.S. objectives in Asia, the desire for a positive relationship with China, and specific rationales for each decision having little or nothing to do with China. The publication of a U.S. Defense Strategy report in January, making clear the priority the U.S. places on the Asia-Pacific and on being able to overcome anti-access strategies of China and Iran, heightened attention to the U.S. strategy. Today, our panelists will talk about these events, what they meant, what their purpose was, whether they represented a new policy, and what reactions have been in the United States, in Asia, and more specifically in China. Our speakers are well known to you, and you will have seen their bios on your way in, so I won't take time to spell out their considerable achievements. Our first speaker will be Ken Liebethal. Ken is the director of the John L. Thornton China Center at Brookings, and was my colleague at NSC in the late 1990s as Senior Director for Asia. Ken will talk about the overall purposes and objectives of the administration's Asia policy and challenges it faces in implementation. The second speaker will be Richard Bush, Director of the Center for Northeast Asia Policy Studies at Brookings, and also a colleague of mine in the late 1990s as National Intelligence Officer for Asia and subsequently Director of the American Institute on Taiwan in Washington. Richard will speak about Asian reactions to U.S. policy. And our third panelist will be Jonathan Pollack, a Brookings Senior Fellow in the Thornton Center, expert on China, Korea, and the rest of Northeast Asia, and author of a wonderful book on North Korea, which I recommend to you all, who will speak about the Chinese reaction to U.S. policy. We will have Q's and A's after the presentations. Ken, over to you.
Thank you very much, Jeff, and let me add thank you for stepping in at the last second to moderate this panel as well as the panel that will immediately follow. I want to address four topics. One, the substance of the pivot, which Jeff kind of enumerated. I want to give a little gloss on that. Secondly, to what extent is this something new that we're seeing? Thirdly, what are the positive aspects of it? And fourthly, what are some of the concerns about, or at least some of my concerns about it? So let me run through each of those in turn. First of all, substance. There are four dimensions, I think, to the set of policies that the President laid out so clearly when he made his trip, his 10-day trip to Asia in November. First, on economics and trade, the focus here was on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We'll be having a much more detailed discussion of that in the second panel this afternoon. Let me just note broadly, this is a multilateral platform that is being negotiated involving countries of the Asia-Pacific region. It is what I would call WTO plus. In other words, it encompasses a lot of the kinds of things in WTO, but adds things like labor standards and environmental standards that go beyond what's in WTO. What was, to my mind, distinctive here is that the President really focused on getting this negotiated and announced by December of 2012, I guess 1 month after the election this year. But it's a timetable that I haven't seen before. I note finally that, and pending this afternoon's later discussion, many of the details of this, including even the ultimate membership of it, remain in a process of development. So this is a target and a focus, but not a set piece that he was putting into place. Secondly, on the military side, the major message was that despite serious potential cuts in anticipated Department of Defense spending over the coming 10 years, our presence in Asia will not be affected by those cuts. A lot of the media focused on the announcement of rotational deployments of U.S. Marines in Darwin, Australia, that will build up eventually to 2,500 people per rotation by 2016. My own feeling is that's a footnote, and that the real message here was overall defense cuts are not going to affect our position in Asia. Thirdly, on the diplomatic side, as Jeff mentioned, there was a focus on the East Asia Summit, the first time a U.S. president has attended that. And on the security side, it was really moving that to the center, I think, of U.S. multilateral security diplomacy in Asia. And then on economics and trade, the TPP. I think in both circumstances, this is moving our focus to forums where the U.S. plays a major leadership role, as versus other forums in which we participate but where we have less of a leadership role or the forum is less active and concrete, such as the ARF versus the EAS. And fourth and finally, human rights and democracy. Frankly, my own sense is that this has not been a centerpiece of Obama administration foreign policy. But I think the Arab Spring inevitably moved that forward as a global democracy agenda. And then developments in Burma have kind of pulled the U.S. into that, and we responded, and that took the form of an announcement of Secretary Clinton's trip that would occur in early December. The announcement was made during the November trip to Asia. So that's a broad kind of substantive pillars of the pivot to Asia. In terms of what is new, I think the key message is this is, in fact, not something that is brand new at all. The key elements of it in most cases go back anywhere from 1 year to more than a decade. For example, U.S. participation in the East Asia Summit was nailed down more than a year ahead of the actual participation in the East Asia Summit. And the Chinese welcomed that, I might add. The TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, was initiated by the Bush administration. This marks an acceleration and specification, but not anything new under the sun that was put forward in November of this year. What is, I think, significant is that the President and the administration have imposed some complementarity and synergy to an array of efforts that have been percolating along in one fashion or another in Asia. And let me say, pulling things together and giving them a synergy is itself a significant accomplishment, one that is typically too difficult for administrations to pull off. I say that as having served in Wang, and I certainly did not think when I was in office that we had an integrated, synergistic policy toward all of Asia. It was just too difficult a thing to pull together. Turning to one of the positive aspects of this kind of packaging, if you will, and integration, I think the main thing is, frankly, that it is region-wide. Fundamentally, that we are thinking in terms of a region-wide, fairly integrated strategy toward all of Asia. Conceptually and bureaucratically, that is very tough to do. I would give the administration, frankly, high marks for moving it as far along as they've been able to do. And I would stress in this that it focuses on the region, not on China. China is clearly a major part of the region. Therefore, China is by no means outside of this. It's a significant part of it. But this whole thing is not how do we stop China. And I think it's a serious mistake to view it in its various components solely through that framework. It also gets the U.S. more positively into the game in terms of the regional economy. And to my mind, one of the great weaknesses of the Obama administration until 2011 was its failure to have a successful economic and trade policy toward Asia. In 2011, we got the CORUS, the free trade agreement with South Korea, moved through on our side and in Seoul. That was a major step forward. Now setting a target date for TPP, I think, simply builds on that and gives it, leverages it in a very effective way. Thirdly, this provides serious assurances on American military priorities, which I think is quite important at a time when it is both well known throughout Asia that we are facing defense budget constraints going forward. Absolute number, hard to specify at this point, but significant constraints. At the same time that the PLA budget continues to go up by double digits every year. And so to make a firm statement that Asia will be protected from defense cuts, I think is a very significant statement to make out in the region. And finally, and by the way, not least at all, I think the president very successfully conveyed a sense of American dynamism. I mean, a lot of people have begun to think America can no longer walk and chew gum at the same time. Right, that we're edging over into decline, we're becoming dysfunctional, et cetera, et cetera. And the capacity, diplomatic and otherwise, to put together this trip with a series of significant elements to it, and to orchestrate it the way we did, and present it as effectively as the president presented it, frankly, I think was pretty impressive. And I think it made a serious impression in the region that we were able to do so. So there was no sense here of the U.S. as a declining power. Rather, there was a reaffirmation the U.S. is here for a very long time and will play a leadership role. I differentiate that from being the leader who gives orders to others. A leadership role is a role that promotes significant outcomes and works with others to achieve them in the region. In terms of the China dimension of this, frankly, I think if this is handled well, this may have a beneficent effect on U.S.-China relations and on China's own activities in the region, and the two obviously are closely linked. You know, my strong feeling is the leadership in Beijing is very pragmatic. I mean, these folks don't live in an ideological bubble. They're astute analysts of the world around them. And they will adapt their policies based on their serious assessment of what they face in Asia. So a demonstration of U.S. clarity of principles and goals, of U.S. diplomatic capabilities, and of U.S. strength can prove very useful in structuring a healthy U.S.-China relationship and a healthy set of relationships throughout Asia. Let me put that slightly differently. If China sees the U.S. as in decline, I think, first of all, part of the narrative in China is very much that a U.S. in decline will work especially hard to prevent China from rising or to constrain China's rise in order to maintain our superiority for as long as we possibly can. And the Chinese will find ways to push back against that quite strongly. So I think actually China seeing the U.S. as vibrant, affirmative, reaching out to China, effective throughout the region, is an image that actually creates more constructive Chinese behavior toward us and provides on our side more confidence to deal with China in a very constructive fashion. So I think that all of this is potentially good news about what occurred. So where are the concerns? My concerns are severalfold. One is simply with the term pivot, which Jeff kind of highlighted in his introductory comments. First of all, pivot, if you think about the meaning of pivot, is not accurate to describe what we are doing here. Pivot suggests that, well, we were looking there, and now we're looking here. Well, I'm sorry, we've been looking here all along. We were also looking there, right? So it suggests that we left Asia and have returned to Asia. And I'm not aware of anyone who studies it seriously who would conclude that we ever left Asia. I would argue that I think the previous administration, Bush administration, took its eye off the ball on Asian regional issues, issues of regional concern to Asia. But they sure didn't take their eye off the ball on U.S.-China relations and U.S.-Japan relations. And so, you know, it was engaged, but, you know, arguably not with as great a nuance on the regional level as they may have been. So I don't think we ever really left. The other unfortunate part of the term pivot is if you can pivot once, you can pivot again. So it suggests that we may not be here for the long run. And again, I think that's absolutely wrong. The other term in the administration that we hear is rebalancing toward Asia. And I think that, in fact, captures it much more effectively. Drawing down expenditure resources in the Middle East, we have a little more bandwidth and capability to give Asia its full due, especially given Asia's continuing growth and its importance in the global arena and therefore in our own future. So I prefer rebalance. But as you can see, we term this whole session the pivot to Asia because, unfortunately, to my mind, that was in the initial press briefing to the White House press corps when they were going to go out and accompany the president. Therefore, it became the term of the trip, and therefore, to fill this room, we figured we better call it the pivot to Asia. Second problem is that it's terribly important to maintain a nuanced balance in what we do. And I think there is the potential for a moderately slippery slope toward growing confrontation with China here. You can spin a narrative about the president's trip and follow-on actions, including our defense strategy that was announced after the trip, that would take things that are relevant to China and portray them as aimed against China. And frankly, I would find an easy time writing those talking points. I happen to think those talking points would be wrong, but they can be powerful. And so I think it requires a lot of self-discipline to make sure that our rhetoric doesn't feed a narrative that will end up being destructive. And in that regard, I have to say that my personal view is that there are somewhat distinct agendas in different parts of the administration related to this policy. Let me say, there are always distinct agendas in any administration related to any broad strategy. I see Doug Paul nodding his head, yes. So Democrats and Republicans both agree on that broad statement. To my mind, the White House approach at its core is we need to fully engage China and also have the United States fully participate overall in Asia's regional dynamism. The latter is not against the former. The two are both extremely important, and we benefit from both. When I look at the State Department, I find a little more fully engaged China, but for the region outside of China, the engagement has more of an edge of warning the region to cohesively make it difficult for China to do bad things in the region. So there's a different edge to some of the rhetoric that I see from some in the State Department out in the region and also back here. More of a resist China initiatives in the region rather than what I deem to be a somewhat different slant on that from the White House. And then thirdly, in the Defense Department, frankly, all of this is part of the battle over future resources for the Defense Department. Whose ox is going to get gored? What weapon systems are going to be procured? Will we build a new major bomber? You know, we don't need a new major bomber to take care of the Kuwait problem, right? So there are a lot of resources that are now up for grabs in the Pentagon, and there is a tendency among some there to explain why we need particular resources in terms of China, which is the most potent explanation you could come up with potentially out there. And then finally, overall, I think the credibility of our strategy is not assured. You have to keep in mind, as we say, TPP and China's welcome to join the TPP if it accepts, you know, the principles laid out by the president and all that kind of thing, that the reality is for every country in Asia, its biggest trade partner is China, not the United States, right? So I see. There's no one who's willing to engage in activities that will cut them off from participating in China's growth, right? And that's a huge constraint. And so as we try to develop something with kind of American principles underlying it, we have to be sensitive to that fundamental reality in the region. President talks, eloquently about U.S. democracy, but U.S. democracy right now, frankly, does not look very good in Asia. It doesn't look very good in Washington, right? I mean, we demonstrate the dysfunctionality of our national level of government day after day after day. And so you're working with a somewhat tarnished image there that you're trying to promote. And that's a problem. And then finally, security in the region is costly. You know, security costs a lot of money. So to say we will protect Asia from any defense cuts is to say we're prepared to spend one heck of a lot of money out in that region for a long period of time. If we can't pull off the economic and trade side of that agenda, China is going to see Asia as a profit center, and for us it's going to be a cost center, and that's not sustainable. Right? So to conclude, let me make three points. One, and I apologize for going about 3 minutes over my time. One, the pivot to Asia is a serious effort at a region-wide integrated strategy. In that regard, frankly, to my mind, it is both admirable and important. Second, we need to take care to manage the rhetoric and actions behind this strategy effectively, because no countries in the region want either sole American dominance of the region or a requirement, effectively, that they choose between America and China. Everyone welcomes U.S.-China competition, but not the kind of friction that would force tough choices on other countries. And we have to be very careful how we manage all this. And then thirdly, and kind of new point in the conclusion, but I anticipated in my earlier remarks, frankly, at the end of the day, the most important single element to our success in Asia will be whether domestically we get our house in order, whether domestically we're able to adopt an integrated set of policies that will effectively address our fiscal problems over time and show that we can actually function effectively politically so that America will bounce back. And if that happens, frankly, this becomes very credible, and a lot of good things follow from that. Thank you very much.
My assignment this afternoon is to look at the responses of China's neighbors to the pivot or rebalancing of U.S. policy. And I agree with a lot of points that Ken has made, but I'll still use most of my time. I would say to Ken that the term pivot has less to do with semantic precision and more to do with the president's favorite sport. I'm going to fulfill my assignment in three different ways. First, I'll inventory how different countries other than China have responded and, moreover, look at differences within individual countries. Second, I'll step back and review the context for recent American steps. And finally, I will assess a bit what's new in all this. On the reaction of countries other than China, my first point is a simple-minded one, that different Asian states responded to American rebalancing in different ways. Take, for example, the announcement that the United States was going to rotate Marines through Darwin. Close U.S. allies like Japan welcomed the announcement. So did friendly countries like India. They said it would contribute to regional stability. Other countries voiced concern or anxiety because of how China might respond. Thus, the Indonesian foreign minister's initial comment noted the danger of a, quote, vicious cycle of tensions and mistrust, close quotes. the Malaysian prime minister worried about increased tensions. Even Singapore's foreign minister observed that ASEAN states want to avoid getting, as he put it, caught between the competing interests of major powers. I don't think any of this should be surprising. Different Asian countries have different interests. They will respond in different ways to the moves of the major powers. Northeast Asia has a different dynamic than Southeast Asia. And within Southeast Asia, various ASEAN countries view the regional reality differently and depend on the United States to different degrees. If you look at Japan, it has a rather dire view of China's long-term intentions, but it hasn't taken particularly robust steps on its own in response. So its dependence on the United States to deter both China and North Korea is rather high. Cambodia is probably on the other end of the spectrum and aligns with Chinese interests. We should also note that just because the United States has reaffirmed its commitment as an Asia-Pacific power, it doesn't mean automatically that we have better security relations with our friends in the region. U.S.-Japan ties remain stuck on the relocation of the Futenma Marine Air Station, and there is the possibility that some of our Asian partners will seek to extend our commitment to them in ways that are good for them, but not necessarily good for us. The Philippines' desire to get us to make a commitment to the defense of the Spratly Islands that they control is a case in point. I think the fundamental reality is that all Asian countries and the United States want to have good relations with both Asian states want to have good relations with both the United States and China. Regarding China, they want the benefit of economic engagement and a reduction of tensions, as do we. From the United States, Asian countries want a security hedge should their ties with China go wrong. So it's interesting that not too long after the president's November swing through the region, South Korean President Im Yong-bak and Japanese Prime Minister Noda went to Beijing. And last month, both Thailand and Vietnam welcomed China's Vice President Xi Jinping for visits. So they're playing both sides of the street. I would say that although Asian countries don't want to get crushed in a nutcracker of U.S.-China competition, they do want a balanced competition to continue. One reason it seems that Burma has been willing to engage Washington is that it needs to create greater balance to its relations with China. For the rest, however they define their interest, the last thing they want is for the United States to take itself out of the game. At the same time, they want us to be smart in the way that we serve our counterweight function. My second point in this, or subpoint in the first point, is that for most Asian countries, the government's response is not the only response. These are all pluralistic nations where the definition of national interest is contested, including the role of the United States. So if government supported American rebalancing, the media in those countries, which reflects that domestic pluralism, was more skeptical. In South Korea, for example, even conservative dailies that are generally pro-U.S. criticized President Lee's so-called diplomatic dependence, unquote, on the United States and urged that he strengthen China ties. The views of progressive South Korean media made those same points, but more strongly. Similarly, on President Obama's new defense plan, Seoul officials publicly supported the announcement and stated that its impact on South Korea would be negligible. ROK media outlets, on the other hand, expressed concern about reduced American troop levels sometime in the future, and that South Korea would have to shoulder an increased defense spending burden. These understandable divisions within countries limit the freedom of action of leaders outside their country and, by the way, suggest an agenda for U.S. public diplomacy. the administration will have to make a continuing effort to shape Asian opinion in favor of its policies. Let me turn to issue number two and what caused the U.S. pivot and how our friends and allies are part of that cause. Generally, I think that our policymakers have come to the strategic recognition that the Asia position is where the action is and will be in international affairs. How the dynamics of the Asia-Pacific play out over the next couple of decades will determine the future of the international system as a whole. And you won't be surprised to know that I, as an Asian specialist, believe that our leaders are absolutely correct in this assessment. Now, let's set aside my parochial views. The dynamics of China's revival as a great power will be much more complicated than previous periods of power transition. Opportunities and risks will coexist, and there's little certainty about the long term. One of those dynamics, of course, will concern the choices that second-tier regional powers make. Do they stress accommodation with China or balancing against it? And their answers, in turn, will be a function of the U.S. Stance. Looking at the region more specifically, I think that there are some factors in East Asia that determine the pace and scope of the pivot. Most important, I think, was China's behavior in the course of 2010, which alarmed our friends and allies and led them to seek more American backing. Now, this is a complicated subject. Some in Asia and America believe that the pattern of PRC behavior in 2010 reflected a high-level and integrated decision on China's part to toughen policy at all points on its periphery. To borrow another basketball metaphor, this has been seen as a PRC full-court press, or at least a half-court press. I actually disagree with this assessment and think that different factors were at play in different parts of the region. The shift in Korea policy at the end of 2009, I think, appears to have reflected a high-level change in policy in favor of active measures to ensure that the North Korean regime survived. Actions in the South China Sea suggest rather not a change in fundamental policy, but a more aggressive implementation of China's long-term strategy to delay resolution of the fundamental dispute while augmenting China's relative power. Also, there may have been failure in Beijing's command and control over the various Chinese maritime agencies that operate in the South China Sea. Poor command and control were obvious in the fisheries episodes concerning Japan in September 2010 and more recently vis-a-vis South Korea. And other factors at play here are probably stronger nationalism, an overreaction to American economic difficulties, and a more complicated decision-making pattern in Beijing. But in a way, it really doesn't matter whether Hu Jintao ordered each and all of these actions. What's important is that various Asian countries regarded them both as somehow connected to the Chinese state and as threatening their interests. That being the case, it's not surprising that they looked to the United States for help, nor is it surprising that we responded. What we call a pivot was really the cumulative expression of the American response. We did act in different ways in different arenas. We were more careful in our response than the New York Times or Chinese observers give us credit for. We are conscious both of the risk that some of our friends in East Asia might try to lock us into their agendas, and we're conscious of the need to reassure China that ours is not a policy of containment. But one of the threads that runs through the pattern of our behavior is that the United States reacted to the response of our Asian friends to China's actions. There is, finally, the question of how new all of this is. I think that this could be the subject of a whole afternoon symposium. I would simply argue that today's rebalancing looks like an adjustment to a longstanding U.S. approach to the complexities of East Asia. And to summarize that approach, I would quote a formulation by Tom Christensen, who was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the George W. Bush administration. He wrote, quote, "Rather than trying to roll back or contain the growth of Chinese power, the United States has used the combination of a strong U.S. regional presence and a series of creative diplomatic initiatives to encourage Beijing to seek increased influence through diplomatic and economic interactions rather than coercion, and to use that increased influence in a manner that improves the prospects for security and economic prosperity in Asia and around the world." Now, I think Tom's conclusion is spot on. I would have said so if he had been able to be here today. I think the United States will best shape China's future course in a positive way through a regional presence that sets boundaries and by exploiting the opportunities provided by the interests that we share with China. Such an approach does not reject the revival of China as a great power. Far from it, but it does seek to increase the odds that China's revival will be constructive. What is new in all this, and here I agree with Ken, is whether the United States will have both the capacity and the will to continue to provide hegemonic stability and security public goods in regions like East Asia. The impasse over the federal budget is the most obvious manifestation of this new reality, but there's a lot more going on. My anxiety is that we will be unable to act on the commitments the Obama administration has made and that we will disappoint our Asian friends and allies. In conclusion, I'd report that Lee Hsien Loong, the Prime Minister of Singapore, last week did a long interview with Fareed Zakaria at the World Economic Forum at Davos. Among the interesting observations that Prime Minister Lee made were three. One, the United States has had a long-term and benign impact on East Asia. Two, he's glad to see the renewed engagement, even as he recognized that China was wary and watchful about underlying American intentions. And third, he hoped that the United States would be able to sustain its initiative over time. I think the PM got it just about right. Thank you.
Well, I guess in all these sports metaphors, I get to bat cleanup here, at least for this panel. I'm going to try to address three topics this afternoon. The first is to examine some of the near to midterm effects on announced decisions coming out of the Department of Defense as one core component of this overall policy shift. Although Chip Gregson will talk, I think, much more authoritatively in a few minutes later about how we do understand some of these shifts. Second, to examine how these changes are being perceived or read in China, if you will, what some of the initial responses are from China, what we might anticipate in terms of either continuity or discontinuity in Chinese behavior. And then finally, look at some of the prospective longer-term effects of this presumptive strategic shift on U.S.-China relations and on East Asia-Pacific as a whole. We tend still, in a shorthand, to use East Asia, but obviously the conception here goes much broader than that. Let me begin very, very quickly with a few immediate facts and outcomes. As Ken Lieberthal noted before, when President Obama visited Australia, he announced the redeployment or rotational deployment of Marine units in limited numbers to northern Australia. There was also reference made to heightened Air Force training that would be undertaken in Australia. Both of these, frankly, are not really new in some fundamental sense. There's been discussions about a more distributed capability on the part of DOD for any number of years, going back at least to the 1980s, but certainly in the 1990s as well. recognizing that there are not boundless opportunities for the United States to exercise its forces in areas that happen to have the virtue of a lot of land where they can operate. What's happened, though, since the president's trip and even more since the enunciation of the new DOD document is perhaps a bit more quietly, Secretary of Defense Panetta last week began to let some of the other shoes drop. That is to say, if you are positing the retention of capabilities in Asia, that under a budgetarily constrained environment, that presumes that you've got to draw down other kinds of forces, other kinds of activities, if you will make up for the difference. So this is, if you will, the meat on the bones, or maybe finding out where the meat will no longer be on the bones. Now, in this respect, the presumptive budget reductions that Secretary Panetta has announced only cover the first 5 years of the presumed 10-year defense drawdown that's been discussed. Again, this is a numbers game. Any number can play. There's a certain softness in these numbers. But what we see are initial announcements that presume the withdrawal of two U.S. battalions from Western Europe to be compensated for by rotational deployments to Western Europe, curtailment of pay and benefits for military personnel, elongating the production line for the Joint Strike Fighter, and again, although hinted at only now initially, a future round of base realignment and closure in the United States, which, again, is always an incredibly politically and budgetarily intense issue. Because then you're really talking about jobs, monies, institutional equities, and so forth, which are always a subtext of this process. So who wins these initial rounds in the budget battles, if I could be a bit cynical, perhaps? What's striking is that we will retain 11 carrier battle groups, so no reductions in the carrier battle group presence, the presumption that the United States will have an undiminished role in maritime security as a whole. In addition, reference to heightened production of attack submarines and cruise missiles, including the possibility of a land attack cruise missile for submarines. There is, as Ken noted earlier, an initial green light for a new U.S. Air Force bomber. And although I'm unaware of detailed discussions coming from any Air Force personnel about this, this would presumably be a bomber that would compensate for the fact that the emergence of so-called anti-access capabilities will be inhibiting on the operations of U.S. carriers, potentially also affecting other U.S. capabilities. Therefore, you need something with longer legs from farther away that could handle a variety of roles and missions. Collectively, I would argue, these capabilities suggest a more offensive capability on the part of the United States in years to come, even as the United States retains its traditional maritime dominance. The theory, of course, is that such steps will inhibit and constrain various states, but China in particular, from its presumed capacity to hold U.S. targets at risk, and that the United States, therefore, must retain the capability and the means to prevent China from any curtailment of U.S. freedom of action anywhere in the Asia-Pacific region. This doesn't necessarily translate into an arms race, but in its maximal version, I would argue all U.S. taxpayers had better be prepared to open their wallets much more fully if this is the path we take. Now, will these effects have a measurable influence on Chinese priorities and strategies? This is question number two. It may well be that some in Beijing, the more sober folks in Beijing, may be reflecting a bit on the extent to which some of their own behavior contributed directly to the heightened concern on the part of the United States for China's military augmentation. But I would say that in the near-term sense, Most of what I have seen has been to affirm existing Chinese policy. In other words, at least, although there certainly are some commentaries that are sharper, but strikingly, more of the sharp comments coming from China these days has more to do with U.S. economic policy towards China rather than towards the strategic orientation in terms of military capabilities. In a near-term sense, this suggests to me that rather than sharp alterations in Chinese strategy, it will reinforce many of the developments that we have seen over the past few years that have caused heightened concern, in particular in the Pentagon, that the PLA's claim on resources would therefore likely to be sustained if it does indeed appear that the United States is embarking on a more offensive strategy, particularly in the West Pacific. So the whole question of rather than altering China's policy directions, the very effort to deny China these options through coercive steps on the part of the United States may make it easier for those within the Chinese system who do in fact presume malign American intent. Now, done judiciously, I think we could see inhibitions on things the United States might undertake, but that China might undertake, but I think we need to proceed very, very carefully. Again, these are actions we are taking on our own as the Chinese take it on their own, and there is sadly a very, very underdeveloped set of discussions between the United States and China on these issues. There is at the same time, I think, real liabilities in the risks of an overly militarized U.S. strategy. Many would say if you look at the changes since the end of the Cold War, the predominant effort on the emergence of the Asia-Pacific region as a whole, and China in particular, in terms of its economic capabilities, that it seems odd to be thinking in terms of military measures. But let's recognize that for the last 10 years or so, the United States has been distracted, if at a minimum, by its military obligations in Iraq and Afghanistan that have drained the United States of enormous sums of money, as well as enormous blood and sacrifice. So, as others have noted, this idea of shifting away from a focus on other parts of the world, hopefully being able to exit gracefully from these conflicts, may enable now a focus again on what is happening across the Asia-Pacific region. But I would say that there is an inherent risk that China's growing military power will be seen by some as, in essence, the means to save a very, very large U.S. defense budget and provide the United States, some would argue, with a much more singular organizing focus in its military strategy that it has obviously lacked since the demise of the Soviet Union. So we ought to be asking, on the part of the United States, power projection for what? What are we seeking to prevent? What do we fear? What is the message we are seeking to send to China? No state wants its freedom of action curtailed, but the question is whether or not we can achieve understandings with China that have a sufficient basis for mutual understanding and even a degree of restraint, as opposed to proceeding to a retreat to an undue focus on military operations as the defining point of our respective strategies. So there's a default option context that I think we need to examine very, very carefully. In a larger sense, it seems to me, these shifts reflect the Asia-Pacific region's uneasy transition, where words and budgets aside, neither the United States nor China have the means or methods to exercise unconstrained domination. As Richard has pointed out, so much of what has happened here has been this effort to relink to American friends and allies in the region, and I think that that makes a great deal of sense. But no one power has an ability to dominate so comprehensively that they can't look at the responses and the capabilities of others as a factor. There is, of course, in Beijing a lurking suspicion that the United States is not reconciled to China's comprehensive emergence as a major power. But as I noted before, many sober voices in China recognize the extent to which Chinese behavior and China's own pattern of weapons acquisitions has contributed to this process. Much of this, of course, as seen by the United States, is more uncertainty-driven than anything else. Recognizing the difficulties and challenges if the United States is going to be able to use its power in ways that are comparable to the past. This suggests to me an imperative need for a much more serious set of discussions between the United States and China. We both need to avoid speaking in code. We don't want this relationship reduced to simply a military-to-military competition that fails to recognize the enormous stakes that both countries have in a, if you will, a competition, but a competition that is realistically bounded. To establish rules of the game such that neither the United States or China finds themselves in a situation not of their choosing. We are not there yet, and a caution flag, it seems to me, is warranted on where current decisions and policy changes might lead us, less by preference or design and more by default. Are we really talking about the unavoidable stresses and growing pains in the transition path to a very, very different kind of region where neither country finds itself joined at the hip, but where the interconnections between the United States and China are profound and makes the stakes of any kind of heightened tensions much higher. Finally, I would observe that in this, all the references to pivot and so forth, it's not a term that I like either. Super tankers don't pivot. Neither do aircraft carriers. They are not nearly that nimble, if you will. They lumber along. They may shift their course slightly, but we need to bear this in mind as we look ahead. The dual U.S. policy challenge is that we obviously need to build with others a new conception of a political, economic, and security order in the Asia-Pacific region, both with allies and with ascendant powers, and that's not just China. But all of this occurs in a much more budgetarily constrained environment. An inclusive regional order without China fully at the table is simply not imaginable, even as we recognize that economic benefits cannot alone carry such a relationship. So if I look ahead, if we were sitting here in another 15 or 20 years and trying to imagine what the outcome has been from decisions that are being taken today, would we see this as that we are on the cusp of truly pivotal strategic changes, a true turning point in desired directions geared towards stability, prosperity, and shared incentives in the future order? Alternatively, do we run the risk of locking ourselves into a more military-dominated regional strategy that buys neither security nor regional order, but entails enormous political and economic costs and the consequence? Or is this, to some extent, perhaps a somewhat oversold formulation that proves unsustainable politically and budgetarily and with uncertain consequences for the credibility of American power? All good questions, and I hope ones that maybe we'll reconvene in the future and ponder how well we did. Thank you.
I'd like to thank my three colleagues for three excellent and provocative presentations. I'd like to ask the first question to whoever wants to take it, perhaps Ken, but others can join in. It's kind of a series of related questions. Ken, you mostly had praise for the specific steps that the administration took in the last few months. You implicitly had some, or explicitly had some problems with some of the messaging. Were there any steps that the administration took
has taken in the last 3-4 months that either you or other members of the panel would not support. If you'd care to expand a little bit on your thoughts on the public messaging, which I think Jonathan was, I think that was an undercurrent of Jonathan's remarks that was problematic. And last related question is, do you think that the U.S. presidential election had anything to do with either the steps or the messaging? Mm-hmm. Over to you guys. Ken?
I want to take the hardest one first, which is your last one. Yes. I think, you know, this is a political season, and so it's not surprising that the realities of going into an election year would encourage the administration to package this November trip in as integrated, comprehensive, and dynamic a fashion as they can. It is, this was in the days leading up to the announcement that the Select Committee on the Hill failed to reach any agreement whatsoever. And the president was out of town for the last 10 days before that failure was announced. So I think he must have felt it was the better part of wisdom to make those 10 days really count in terms of messaging. On the specific steps, no, in fact, there's nothing that we did that I think was the wrong thing to do. And I think actually where I have a problem with the messaging side is, as I kind of implied in my remarks, it's more with what the Secretary of State was doing while the President was traveling. She joined him for part of the trip, but did her own stop in Manila. And I think if you go back and look at what she said on her trip and what the President said in their respective public remarks, you find that there is some daylight between them. And the Secretary of State was generally, tougher than the President, more closely, for example, talking about the West Philippine Sea and things that, just stuff that kind of suggests there's a real taking sides here. And the President, I thought, was very careful not to make those suggestions, although some of his rhetoric, especially in Australia, came close. I thought, nevertheless, the Secretary went farther, and I thought, frankly, personally, that that was unfortunate.
Richard, John?
I'm glad you raised this question, Jeff. It warrants notice that much of these shifts in strategy, particularly from the point of view of the Defense Department, represent a kind of an out-of-cycle review. The shelf life on some of these documents coming out of the Pentagon seems to be getting much more attenuated, and it seems a very different time that back in 2009, Secretary of Defense Gates castigated so many in the Pentagon for what he referred to contemptuously as future war-itis. We seem to be back in that domain now, looking maybe not unreasonably at what are the kinds of capabilities you think you need to acquire looking ahead. I think that the fact that this is all occurring in an election year is no accident. Quite the contrary. I think it really highlights the extent to which, even if this did serve a major purpose in relation to perceptions of the United States in the region, it also has a utility in U.S. domestic politics as well.
We'll take questions from you all. We can wait for microphones, and we'll first row.
See who it is.
Yeah, if you could identify yourself and your organization, please.
Thanks. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report. And I want to ask about two elements of this scenario that we didn't spend much time on. The first is, and it's in the context of sort of imagining, looking out a decade or two from now, what might the configuration look like. The first piece of this is something that was articulated in a book a couple of years ago by Bill Emmett from The Economist, in a book called The Rivals, in which he noted that this would be the first time in history that Japan, China, and India were essentially world powers or competing world powers, all sort of coming into that at various speeds and size, and that the potential for regional competition between among those three is at least as significant as the ostensible potential between the U.S. and China. So that's one factor that I would be interested to get your reaction to. The second is noted in the Economist's cover story this week on China about the paradox of prosperity, and a spate of articles that have been written in the last month or two about China and Asia, in which, as the Economist puts it, the paradox of prosperity in China is that in order for China to continue its economic success, it will have to face political changes that are inimical both to the Chinese philosophically and also, arguably, to the engines of growth themselves. So I'm interested to know whether either, I'm interested to get your reaction to either of or both of those, the regional competitive piece and the domestic political piece. What's the salience of either of those, and what's the likelihood that those could be game changers?
Anyone?
Why don't I take a stab at the regional piece? I think one of the ironic but I think potentially helpful aspects of these shifts in strategy is to give regional actors, not only the major regional powers but also the middle regional powers, a different set of incentives for relationships and understandings vis-a-vis one another. That, I think, would be widely endorsed, or ought to be widely endorsed, by the United States. I think we need to remember that however central the United States may like to see itself, excuse me, in Asia and elsewhere, indeed it was fascinating to see in President Obama's State of the Union address, he trotted out the line used by Madeleine Albright years ago about America being the indispensable power. Perhaps we are, but I think that in a relative sense, and this isn't to bemoan these changes or to say that this makes the U.S., puts the U.S. in a situation of decline, in a relative sense, the capacities of others are going up. We have ample incentives to cooperate with all of them, but even more important, if a true regional order is to be built, that's going to be something that falls much more on their respective hands than for the United States designing it from afar, if you will. That would be my thought. I don't know if anyone wants to tackle the domestic issue, but
let me just follow on the same thing. I mean, as I look at the interrelationships among the three powers you cited, I don't see a situation emerging where you have, if you will, an irresistible force and an immovable object. If there's going to be conflict, it's more likely to be because of friction through accident or miscalculation. Also, don't sort of neglect the role of third parties or fourth parties to sort of entrap in conflict countries that don't have an interest to be fighting each other. And here, North Korea and Pakistan come to mind.
On your question about the regional thing, 10 years from now, I think what we ought to keep in mind is no one knows what 10 years from now will look like, and there's no way to know. The role of accident, the role of the development of different technologies that have their own dynamics, recently, for example, social media, right, having a huge role around the world. It's 5 years old. 10 years ago, no one knew this was coming, right? I think we know very little about 10 years from now, even though we all have to make some plans based on assumptions about it. Those assumptions almost certainly will prove significantly wrong. But let me really address your first question about the domestic side in China, or second question, I guess, about the domestic side in China. I commented in my remarks how important the U.S. rebalancing its own economy would be to our success going forward. I could have said the same thing with equal force about China. In our typically different ways, the Chinese have already laid out their plans to rebalance their economy. The question there is whether they can implement them. With us, we're fighting over what the plans ought to be. Right? But China's China has tremendous economic growth momentum. And when you look at things like urbanization and the demand drivers that urbanization creates, the Chinese economy in some form or other is going to become the largest economy in the world by 15 years from now, and probably long before that. But what kind of economy it is and how effective that makes China in dealing regionally and globally is really up for grabs. Mm-hmm. And I would argue the issue is not whether they undertake reforms that will undermine the system. The question is whether they undertake reforms that will preserve the system, right? But significant reforms are necessary that have been systematically postponed by the current administration in China. And therefore, the new administration is going to have one hell of an inbox. I think they know that very clearly. I think it's going to be 2 or 3 years before they can even begin to take those issues up seriously, changing incentives for provincial leaders, figuring out which major interest groups are going to be undercut as they rebalance the economy and so forth. So it's probably going to be 2014, 2015 before they even engage the issue seriously. And the cost to them of not engaging it go up every year.
If I could just add, there's some theorists of international relations who like to talk about regional hegemony and sort of take the U.S. experience, historic experience in Latin America as a model for what China may wish to do in East Asia, sort of a Monroe Doctrine for Asia. I'm not sure who the Chinese historic figure is who correlates to James Monroe.
Monroe
Doctrine. But I think the question you've asked implicitly demonstrates how inapt that historic analogy is. The notion that Japan, that India, I think you can add to that list, Indonesia and Vietnam, would accept some sort of subordination of their national interests or some kind of bandwagoning with China, with a rising China, and become part of some bloc dominated by China, I think is contrary to everything we know about these countries' history. Chris?
Thanks very much. Great discussion. I want to engrave Jonathan's last two or three paragraphs in bronze and pass them around if we can about the need to discuss things. As you know, I've been writing about this for the last few weeks. And
identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Chris Nelson, Nelson Report. Start talking without thinking.
Everyone knows Chris.
Yeah. Never mind. Is it too soon to be looking at the utility of something like arms control talks for the future of Asia? Because what we're all talking about is an inevitable feedback process of they're doing this, so we're going to do that. If we don't do this, we're accused of not being strong. And, we all know the rhetoric. And so much of this is starting to remind me of not so much the 1930s, but the 1950s. And we're looking back on a lot of sort of opportunities we kind of missed with the Soviets, and they sort of missed with us because we didn't really quite talk about it and we believed the worst about each other. Is it too soon to be looking at a way to discuss with the Chinese, guys, we don't really need to do this stuff, we need to do all of it? Thank you.
Ken, Jonathan?
I'm actually about to publish a paper co-authored where that's one of the recommendations, that it's time that we start at least exploring areas of potential mutual restraint as a way to begin to reduce strategic distrust between the U.S. and China. So, yeah, I think that's one of the things, among others. I've forgotten whether it was Jonathan or Richard who called for more serious, in-depth discussions than we have been having to date. And to my mind, that's one of four or five issues that we ought to be exploring in a serious way.
It is definitely not too early. Hopefully it's not too late, because what I'm struck by, even in this context where there is the growing involvement of the United States and all the different multilateral fora and so forth, you have essentially unconstrained weapons development programs country by country. I mean, to some extent, there's limited transparency, but there has been, so far as I am aware, very little effort either at a conventional or even more interestingly at a nuclear level, to really think through and understand the implications of where countries may be headed and the extent to which that will make much more problematic, to put it mildly, any kind of regulated competition. I'm not trying to say that states won't pursue military modernization, but how they do it, toward what ends, and with what consequences for their mutual relationships and their relations with the United States are all open questions. So beyond all the arm-waving that is often there about peace and collaboration and what have you, these processes continue on their own in any country that can afford these capabilities, and even some that can't.
Chris, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Okay, you're aware, of course, of the proposal of the Obama administration did put forward to the Chinese in the Strategic and Economic Dialogue for a discussion on five particular sensitive security areas: nuclear force modernization, use of outer space for military purposes, cyber issues, ballistic missile defense, and maritime security. And last May at the Strategic and Economic Dialogue, they picked two of those topics for the first discussions, cyber and maritime security. And the innovation here was not, and for, I mean, two comments on it. The idea was to have the topics that were most susceptible of leading to the classic security dilemma, where two sides see each other taking actions and take counteractions to counteract either real or imagined intentions. And that's how these five topics were chosen. And the other innovation was to try to compel inclusion of both military uniformed officers and civilians in the dialogue, because for decades we've had discussions on some of these topics with the Chinese through foreign ministry channels, but the foreign ministry people know nothing about the topics and know nothing about the decision making or nothing about the strategy. So they are classic barbarian handlers in these discussions. So the idea was to get the PLA involved. Now, the first discussions, you know, there was, I don't know, an hour or so on each. How much can you do in an hour? And what you're talking about, I think, is sort of agreements and constraints. We are very, very far from that with a China that is uncomfortable even having these discussions, no less reaching agreements on them. But I'd say it's a baby step. Richard, did you...
Chris, I'm in principle not opposed to what you're talking about and the other things my colleagues have mentioned. I would note, though, that 90 years ago, more or less, in this city, there was an arms control agreement for Asia and the Pacific, the Washington Naval Conference.
It's good for, and it failed. Years. It's good for a decade.
The effort to limit capabilities did not work to restrain the impulses that existed on Japan's part.
That's what I mentioned, the 1950s.
and so it's real tough. Verification is real hard when you move from strategic to conventional. I think there are also sort of institutional dynamics in different countries. Procurement's driven by threat perception, and unless you control threat perception, how can you control the other? And so on and so on. Thanks.
Let's try Matt. Matt Goodman, purple tie. Gentleman in the purple tie behind you. The gentleman behind you, please. Thank you.
Can we do twofer?
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Matthew Goodman, CSIS.
Yes, you're Matt Goodman as well. Thank you.
Matthew Goodman, CSIS, until recently in the Obama White House. I want to ask a question of Richard, but I want to comment on something that Ken said, which was about the not forcing China to people to choose between the U.S. and China in the context of TPP. And I think that and other cautionary notes you made are very well taken, and I think the administration's mindful of that. And I guess I would say that with respect to TPP, you know, it's a voluntary undertaking. It's a negotiation. I think it's true, probably. The administration wants to establish a set of high standard rules that are more in the American image than others, and that has an element of trying to shape Chinese behavior. But although I don't think that's the primary driver, but I think that may be an element of it. But it is a negotiation, and so we'll push and prod, they'll push and prod and resist, and we'll come out somewhere in between. So I don't think the people who are participating in TPP are, you know, reluctant or worried about, you know, the China thing. There was a long queue of countries outside the door trying to get into that room. So I think, you know, it's a little more. I mean, it's a good point to be mindful of, but I think it's not so operational in the TPP context. The question for Richard is, you expressed anxiety about follow through, and I share that anxiety. What would your some of the elements of important follow through be in your view to show that this rebalancing, which is probably the right word, although it does have two extra syllables, which is inelegant, but that would follow through, and what sort of metrics would you use to measure whether, you know, follow through had occurred?
I guess the main one is the one that Ken mentioned, is that over time we get our domestic house in order and restore the pillars of our national power, which we've allowed to atrophy. And sustaining a reasonable defense budget and with smart procurements is only one part of that. I do have the sense that a lot of our diplomacy so far, or the administration's diplomacy so far, has been trip-driven and sort of focused on getting a lot of American, high American officials to the region at one time, and speeches and whatnot. And maybe we've accomplished what we needed to do with that, and what we need is a steadier diplomacy in the various elements of our national power, not so much relying on the president's time or the secretary's time, but Secretary of State's time, but sort of deputy secretaries, undersecretaries going out and sort of getting concrete achievements that we can build on, you know. Actually finishing Futenma in some way, you know, I think would be a real achievement and be a good platform for moving forward with Japan in whatever direction.
Nadia.
Hi, Nadia Chow with the Liberty Time Taiwan. I think the President Obama in his State of Union address, you know, mentioned China six times, but majorly on economics. And yesterday, the deputy, you know, national advisor also mentioned the major differences between U.S. and China is economics issue. And right now, the AIT chairman, you know, Raymond Berhard, is talking about beef in Taiwan. I'm just wondering, during the election year, is U.S., you know, Obama administration is ready to play hardball with the, you know, Asian country on economic issues? If that's so, you know, what do the tours, extra tour U.S. have? And does U.S. worry about the, you know, the counterbalance or pushback, since most of the Asian country, you know, also have their own domestic pressure on economic growth? Thanks.
Looking just at Taiwan and what my friend Ray Burkhardt is doing, I would say that actually his focus on beef is really part of a larger discussion of the need for Taiwan to continue to liberalize its economy, not only vis-a-vis China, but vis-a-vis its other trading partners, including the United States. And that effort is being held back by problems on specific issues. We need to move those specific issues out of the way so we can get to what is really important in our economic relationship. And that's not because it's in U.S. interest, it's because it's in Taiwan's interest. That's the way, one of the ways that Taiwan is going to remain competitive in a very competitive, globalized economy.
Ken?
I think in a time of global economic stress and in a time of elections and successions, and especially in Asia, when you think, you know, Asia Pacific, it's the U.S., China, South Korea, Taiwan, Russia, conceivably Japan, all this year have a national level election or succession, that inevitably protectionist forces rise. And I think President Obama's actions, what he mentioned specifically in the State of the Union message, was that he is establishing an interagency group to really focus on rigorous implementation of trade policy. Not new protectionist measures, but rigorous implementation of trade policy. I think, frankly, that's a smart idea. First of all, where other countries aren't playing by the rules, we should hold them to account. We've got an economy in stress, and we ought to, you know, implement our policies rigorously in accordance with our national obligations. But secondly, it also is a way to make less likely more severe and less helpful measures from being taken in a politically tough year. So I think that's really what he's talking about. Frankly, with specific respect to China, my own read, Jeff would know better, but I'm not going to put him on the spot. My own read is that the president is genuinely very angry at China's not playing by the rules, at domestic subsidies and all kinds of other things that put U.S. firms and other global firms at a disadvantage and work to China's unilateral advantage. So I think he's very serious, but I don't think he's proposing a whole set of new protectionist measures. He's saying, I'm not going to shy away from vigorous implementation of what's on the books. And frankly, I think that's a correct policy.
If I could just add, first of all, Ken obviously is channeling me here. What he said is an absolutely correct description of how the president views Chinese economic practices. If you look at what Secretary Geithner had to say the other day in Davos, where he was asked a question by Fariza Karia about China, and he dove directly into precisely the points that Ken made about Chinese subsidies, Chinese industrial policy, and the imbalances and dysfunctions these are producing for the world economy. I think that there, then look at what Governor Romney has been saying about China. Look more recently at what the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee said about possible legislation on countervailing duties against non-market economies, specifically China. I think that there is something of a shift going on in the way Americans, American business, American political class views the Chinese economy. I guess what I would say is the stagnation of reform in recent years. There are real risks of the world moving in a very protectionist direction towards China, not because of elections, but because of Chinese practices. I don't put a November timetable on it, but this is a reality that is not going to go away unless China takes more seriously the concerns of other countries. Let's take the gentleman in the middle there.
Thank you. Dong Huiyu with the China News Review News Agency. My question is, how significant will the upcoming visit by Chinese Vice President Xi Jinping be for the U.S. government to assure the new generations of Chinese leaders that the U.S. pivot to Asia is not trying to contain China? What do you expect from Vice President Xi? Do you think he will be more aggressive and stiff, or more practical or flexible to deal with the U.S.? Thank you.
First of all, we have been assuring China privately in every way we can that the U.S. pivot to Asia is not aimed at China. So I think the Xi Jinping visit should be seen in that context. This is not the first time we have a chance to talk to top Chinese officials about this issue. Secondly, in terms of Xi's own attitude, he laid that out a couple of weeks ago, where he really stressed the need to have a positive win-win kind of relationship with the United States. So he's teed up this visit in very positive terms. Thirdly, I think the real purpose of the visit, or at least my own view is the real purpose of the visit, is to get Vice President Xi around to meet with our top cabinet officials and with the president, because after all, he is going to become the head of China. And so I think it's an opportunity for him to sit down with President Obama, with Secretary Clinton, I assume Secretary Geithner, Secretary Panetta, and so forth, and really begin to get a personal relationship or set of relationships going with a certain comfort level to it.
I agree with you.
I think we have time for one more question before the break, and then we're coming back for another panel.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Boder from Congressional Quarterly. I'd like to go back to the earlier discussion a little bit about India. In the Defense Department's white paper that came out earlier this month, they spoke specifically about the United States wanting to, as part of the pivot toward Asia, developing a long-term strategic relationship with India. Now, you talk to different people around town, and you get different descriptions of what this long-term strategic partnership would entail. You know, talk to people on the business council, and they talk about endless U.S. arms sales and business with India. But also, they talk about more than just a partnership. They talk about an alliance, very much with India acting as a counterweight toward China.
Toward these people.
And but then you talk to people from, you know, at the Indian embassy, and they have a lot of reluctance to describe themselves as an ally of the United States. What I'd like to ask Jonathan, and if any of the others have anything to add, is what can one realistically expect from this partnership, between this long-term strategic partnership with India?
I think the challenges of building and sustaining a strategic partnership of the sort that some believe is possible with India will be nearly as great as those involving China. India has no desire to be an American ally, to be tethered to an American strategy, to take orders from the United States, to be America's deputy in Asia. It just simply runs against the grain of Indian strategic thinking and Indian interests. So the first thing I would advise is to be realistic about India. I mean, we can even see already, for example, even if there are dreams of major weapon sales, the Indians have just announced that they will purchase the Rafale. So they don't feel sufficiently indebted to the United States, therefore, that you have to buy American weapons systems. You do have, of course, a vigorous debate in India about the long-term relationship with China, understandably. There's a lot of unpleasant history that they both deal with. But I just think it would be advisable to set the sights a little more realistically here. In particular, to, in effect, designate India without India having sought that. I mean, the DoD document specifies this is what we ought to do. It might be useful if we check with the Indians about this. In a curious kind of way, it reminds me of debates from long ago and far away when senior U.S. officials dreamed about China being the next member of NATO to oppose the Soviet Union. Ill-advised and at any number of levels. So I think India will be a much more consequential power. I think we have an enormous set of incentives to work with the Indians towards that goal, but let's not get off in these fanciful scenarios of how India will just do our bidding, if you will.
On that very realistic note, we are going to take a break. Thank you to our panelists for three very superb presentations and for the Q's and A's. We will...
be back at 3:15 for the next panel on Trans-Pacific Partnership and U.S. military strategy in the region. Thank you.